Welcome to Scape Foo, episode 29. Today we're talking about the largest nature aquarium in the world, made by Takashi Amano for the Lisbon Oceanario. It's going to be an exciting one. We have a behind-the-scenes tour and experiences from our very own Yudis, who was one of the 40 or so volunteers that was there during that time. So it was an amazing experience, and we can't wait to hear it. Here we go.
Welcome to the Scape Foo Podcast, where it's all about learning to make aquariums beautiful. And now, here are your hosts, Scape Foo founder and chief bottle washer, Art Pinom, your DIY homescaper, JJ, and our full-time aquascaper and smarty pants from Germany, Yuri's Mitt JS.
And welcome to Scape Foo, episode 29. We're talking large, world's largest nature aquarium today. I'm Art Pranam, your host, and I'm here as usual with JJ and Yuri. Guys, how are you?
Morning. Good.
Hello, everybody.
So I think this is going to be an exciting one. I've been waiting for a while. I think, guys, we've been teasing people about this episode and what Yuri is going to share with us. So I'm excited to talk about it and learn what happened. I think it was an amazing experience, Yudis. But before we get there, why don't we cover the news, as always, and then we'll dive into the large nature aquarium, underwater forests. So from the news perspective, all I have today is, a couple of things. One is the Aquatic Gardeners Association Convention 2015. If you're listening to this before April 10th or the 12th, through the 12th, 2015, then you're in time to register and go. It's going to be an amazing experience in Reston, Virginia. That's right by D.C., Washington, D.C. And we have some amazing speakers. We have George Farmer all the way from the UK on the other side of the pond making the trip. And not only is he going to talk, but he's dueling it out with Mike Senske of the U.S. team. And Jeff Senske will be the MC for the Iron Aquascaper duel. I think that will be a thing to watch. Now, you think George, JJ, is a little bit nervous that his brother's MCing and
George
favoritism
or Jeff?
There? George, a little nervous that not his brother, right? Jeff's Mike's brother is the MC here. I don't know. I'm sure Jeff will be.
I don't think he is, but I'm sure he'll get heckled a little bit.
Little bit of heckling. I hope
so. Yeah,
I'm
sure.
That'll be fun. No, I'm sure Jeff is going to be neutral.
I got to talk to Jeff a little bit at the aquatic experience, and he's pretty cool. But he seems like he's got that to him. You know, I'm sure he's like that with his brother.
Maybe Mike is the one getting heckled and not George. So we'll see. It should be fun. If you're going, please, you'll see JJ and myself hopefully wearing some Scape Foo shirts and pretty obvious. Just come up to us and say hello.
I'll have Scape Foo on my badge also.
Great. I don't know if I will. We'll see. But
you can just call up or email Cheryl.
Yeah, I'll do that. If not, I'll handwrite it in. No problem.
Yeah, she'll put the logo and everything for you.
Another piece of news that I want to bring to the table today is that the International Aquatic Plant Layout Contest. This is the largest aquascaping contest in the world, started, funded by Aqua Design Amano, Takashi Amano's company. The 2015 entry started early. They were supposed to start April 1st. But I guess they got their act together and they just opened it up on March 25th. So it's open. Again, if you're listening to this at around the time that we are recording and we'll get it out in 2015, the applications are there. So if you're looking to submit to that contest, and I highly encourage you to do so, it's open. Go over there to, I'll have a link in the show notes. And again, everybody, the show notes for this episode, as usual, is scapefoo.com/ and then the episode number. This one is 29. Anytime you want to reach the show notes, scapefoo.com/ the episode number. This one, 29. So we'll have a link. One thing that I noted when I went to the page that I hadn't seen before, but maybe Yudis, you can confirm or tell me I'm wrong. This time I noted that they have some ADA authorized local contests throughout the world. And they're saying that submissions of identical work to the following ADA authorized local contests being held around the world are approved only if the applicant shall not release the work through the internet publication or any other distribution media prior to the official results being announced by ADA. And the local contests are the AGA, International Aquascaping Contest in the USA. In Germany, the European Aquatic Plants Layout Contest. In Thailand, Thailand Best Aquascaper Contest. And in India, the Great Indian Aquascaping Contest. So if you're in one of those, you can submit identical work to the ADA, as far as I understand it, and as long as you didn't otherwise publish it to anywhere, it'll be fine. You won't get disqualified. Now, Yudis, have they had this before? Is this something new this year?
Well, basically, it is like the same before. As I work very close with ADA Germany, and I'm the organizer of the EAPLC, previous GAPLC, we received a request from Japan, and they asked or told us they are collecting the information from local contests because they would like to have overview about the local contests, and they also collected the information when is the submission period, when it begins, when it ends, and when the results are published. So, in our case, EAPLC European contest is proved because we will, in any case, we will publish the works only after the contest, the international one from Japan. And so that's what they did. They published this on the webpage to demonstrate people that it is safe to participate in this local contest with the same photo as in the international contest. And I think it makes it more clear for people where they can participate without any risk getting disqualified from the international contest. And but generally nothing changed as in the past. You can participate in local contests as long as they do not reveal your photo to public before they do in Japan. So,
you know, I love this coordination. I mean, if I look forward, I'm seeing this coordination amongst the contests and maybe even a sporting type analysis here or analogy, where a lot of these smaller regional contests become the qualifiers for the big international one, and the international one is not sponsored only by a commercial entity like ADA, but a body that that manages all of this. So I really like the coordination that ADA is doing here. I think, like you just said, it does make clear to everybody that it's okay to submit and what are the ground rules, et cetera, and coordinating with the contest to make sure that they don't release before the ADA one. I mean, it's all kind of working together, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I really like that. So any other news, guys? No?
Nope.
All right. Why don't we then dive into the meat of the show, and let's start talking large, large aquariums. Okay, so today we have the pleasure and privilege, really, to be sitting with one of the people that was there when this exhibit, the world's largest nature aquarium, was put together and actually assisted. Yudis, that being you. It's at the Lisbon Oceanario, which is the aquarium in Lisbon. It's, I believe, from what I saw on the web, the second largest in Europe. It's huge. It's a beautiful venue. I'll have a link in the show notes. And they apparently engaged Takashi Amano and ADA to come over and put this together for them. Now, Yudis, what can you tell us? I mean, what is it? Can you tell everybody what it is, why it was done, so we can get started?
So, first of all, it is important to know that the Oceanarium in Lisbon has two buildings. One is the major building with the general exhibition with all the sharks and everything, and then there is a second building where is always a temporary exhibition, and this project by Amano is such a temporary exhibition. So it is a world record, but it will only last for 2 or 3 years because it is a temporary exhibition. For this reason, it's very important to go there as early as possible, because maybe in a couple of years it won't be there anymore. So so this is in general. So this is a temporary exhibition, and it's huge.
In Portuguese, it's Florestas Submersas, I believe, which translates to underwater forests in English. I'll have a link in the show notes to the Oceanario website, the English version of it, which I think is translated pretty well, giving some of the background. And the exhibit opens April 22nd, right, Yudis?
This is correct.
Okay. And I believe from the information that is there, it's going to be around, it's a temporary exhibit, the second one that they do, and it's going to be around for 30 months. So I think if you can get there again, this is, we're talking in March, end of March 2015, and it's going to open April 22nd, so 30 months from April 22nd, 2015. If you can get out to Lisbon, you can get a wonderful look at it. Now, before we start diving into more specific questions here with Yudis, I do want to note that I'll have some videos that were taken from the putting together of this nature aquarium in the show notes. Again, scapefood.com/29, and we can discuss it. Now, maybe at the beginning, Yudis, we can talk about the physical size of this aquarium. I mean, how big is it?
It is, in total, it is 40 meters long.
40 meters long, which is about 132 feet long. And I have an unfair advantage here because I'm staring at the numbers on the webpage. So do you remember how deep it is?
And the shape, it has a U shape.
Right.
So you have 8 meters on the left side, then it goes around the corner, then you have the middle part, which is 24 meters long, and then again around the corner, you have again 8 meters. So in total, it is 40 meters on the front side of the aquarium. And if you, I would call it, like look from the side. So it is 2.5 meters wide. And the water column is 1.5 meters high.
So 2.5 meters is 8.2 feet, folks. That's really deep. And 1.5 meters, I would imagine that's somewhere between 4 and 5 feet. This is a big, big aquarium that was put together here. I have a few more stats that I'll throw out there before we delve into the experiences. The aquarium's layout includes 4 tons of sand, 25 tons of volcanic rocks from the Azores, 78 tree trunks from Scotland and Malaysia, 40 species of tropical freshwater fish, 46 species of aquatic plants, They're expecting 1.5 million visitors in 30 months. And it's the first aquarium with the author's signature, I'm assuming Takashi Amano, at the Oceanário in Lisboa, in Lisbon. So, and it is, I guess, confirmed by Takashi Amano, obviously the largest nature aquarium ever created. So those are your facts there. To me, it's mind-boggling when I listen to that, but also just looking at the pictures that are on Facebook, that are on YouTube, Yuri's that you posted. We'll have, obviously, in the show notes, pictures for you to take a look at. This thing is huge. I mean, how does, when you're standing there, I mean, what's the impression, Yuri's?
The impression is like you are surrounded by water. So it feels like, you know, you are like, you are somewhere in the nature, in the rainforest, probably. And, you know, it's very dark in the room. So the floor and the walls and the roof is painted black. And there is almost no lights in this room except the aquarium. So there's nothing disturbing you. And it really feels like, I don't know, you're underwater.
You know, and they're saying here on the site that they have a original music composition that was created just for this exhibit by a famous musician and composer. In Portugal, his name is Rodrigo Leal. So I'm sure it's a haunting melody as you're staring there. You know, it kind of reminds me of the experience I had when I saw the Claude Monet's Water Lilies, which is a huge painting if you've ever seen it, and you really feel like you're there. This surround aquarium, because it's U-shaped, I'm sure gives you that impression of just being in it. Now, Yudis, I know I have some questions. JJ, I'm sure you do as well, and I'll ask you, do you mind if I go first?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Yudis, was this the first time you're working with Takashi Amano? And if so, or even if it wasn't, what was your experience this time working with him?
So really working with him was the first time, but it is the third time I met him in person. I met him before in Aarhus in Denmark. It was a regular workshop, and just half year later in Hannover in Germany, also aquascaping workshop. But it's definitely something different just watching him working and work with him together. This is two completely different worlds, because when you are just the, I would call it, you know, like a visitor or a guest, so you're only watching, you're only enjoying, you only see, you know, I would call it the beautiful side of the show, you know. But when you're working for the show, for the creation of this, there is no ugly side. But, you know, you see what's behind the scene, you know, what is required to make it look like this. You know, we all see the videos on ADA View on YouTube, but you don't see and you don't understand what happens there when they create the aquariums. And this was a very, I would call it, you know, unique experience, 1 week long, you know, from the beginning. To work there, and the first thing where we were told, you know, during the first speech was, "Okay, guys, listen. You are here to work. You are not on holiday. You are here to work. You are volunteers, and there is only one rule, and this is the Mr. Amano rule. So when Mr. Amano says, everybody has to." Follow his instructions. Yes.
That sounds like
this is very,
what I would imagine.
You know, way of working.
Well, you know, in on the one hand, I can't really fault that, right? I mean, you have a large number of people, most of which are good aquascapers in and of themselves with their own styles and opinions. But this is his work, right? So he has to say, guys, I'm sure you have a ton of opinions, but this is my work, so you got to do what I'm telling you. So yes. I get that. But then again, I would imagine Takashi Amano saying that, you know, you did it wrong, do it again. So that's interesting. Now, was he there the entire time, or would he give instruction, then leave and come back? Or
I think one day he was not there, but all the other time he was present and always, you know, monitoring, controlling, checking, giving instructions, saying, "I'm change this," and I think one day we were wrapping moss on all the driftwood, and we spent entire day wrapping moss. I'm sure you have seen the pictures where everybody's inside and wrapping moss. And I don't know, you just said 70 pieces of the driftwood. And now imagine there are like 2 meters, 3 meters in size, and you need to cover it with moss, every single piece, every single branch. And when you are done, we had to cover some stones with moss too.
So, I mean, obviously there was a lot of plant materials here coming in. Who was providing all of that?
I'm not sure, but I think they were from Singapore. It's one of the largest plant supplier, Oriental Aquarium, maybe. I don't know. Not sure.
JJ, do you have any question?
Yeah. How did you guys come about being asked to volunteer for this?
I really don't remember the first time I heard about this project. It was maybe a newsletter from ADA, or maybe I was talking by phone with the ADA Germany distributor, and he told me. However, my first idea was I need to get there if there is any possibility, and I'm ready to help, being volunteer and, you know, like travel there, stay there all on my own expenses, you know, like doing it for free, just being there, just being part of the project. And I offered myself, I asked the German distributor to ask in Japan if they need some volunteers, and maybe, I don't know, 1 or 2 months later, I received the first sort of confirmation, and I think it was by the middle of January, I received the first email from Japan, which was just like 2 or 3 weeks before the project. So I was maybe the first one who offered himself being
a volunteer. It was your idea.
Yeah, lucky me. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think a lot of
Well, you saved ADA a ton of money. Otherwise, they would have to ship everybody from Japan. Good thinking.
I don't really think, you know, being there and after the project, there was a question of money. I mean, such a project in total is like, I don't know, 1 million plus. So really few more flight tickets really doesn't matter. So I think
it's a once in a lifetime thing, though.
Excuse me?
I said it's once in a lifetime thing, you know?
Yeah, and I really think they wanted to get some people, some enthusiasts, some people involved into the hobby, to get involved into the project, you know, because you see today, we can talk about this, you know, we do advertising in sort of way for this project, and we share information. And if they took only Japanese stuff, you know, there wouldn't be such, you know, such information from so many different people.
Now, were you able to give information, like give your thoughts?
Yes, we had before we went there. We had to sign an agreement that we will not share any information, written, audio, video, however, about this project before we get the permission. And
that's why we couldn't talk about it until now.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Another question.
We received this permission at just, I don't know, 1 week ago or something. And for this reason, all the guys involved started sharing pictures on Facebook like crazy. I believe it was
Do you think it broke earlier, or you think people waited until they got the okay?
The people were waiting. We had to sign the agreement.
Yeah. You know, from my perspective, I mean, one of the things that I saw that for me was a big deal was, I mean, this must be one of the first times that so many talented aquascapers come together from different parts of the world to do a project.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, that says something. It's no longer, you know, I know in Hungary and in other places, there's been a gathering of aquascapers that come together to do a project or give an exhibition or something like that. But this is really globally.
Yes.
I was gonna ask, what was the camaraderie like working with so many people?
Excuse me, can you repeat, please?
What was it like working with everybody? The camaraderie.
Oh, it was great. We were all like one big family. Of course, there was, you know, like a little separation between the teams. And there were three teams. There was one team from Japan, and there was one team from the ocean area, Lisbon, and there was one team of volunteers. And, you know, all the volunteers, we were all in the same hotel. We were always hanging around together, having together lunch, breakfast, dinner. And and it was a little bit difficult to get, you know, more in touch with some of the Japanese staff, because they hardly speak English, most of them. Just a few speak English very well. So it was always like Mr. Amano was giving the instructions in Japanese, and somebody was translating to us what to do. And but we were all working together very well. You know, there were like no unfriendly situations. So it was really not present. So from the beginning till the end, we were one big happy family.
A lot of camaraderie. That's great. Was Nozomi Hayakawa there?
Yes.
Ah, okay. He's still there.
He was translating most of the time.
Yes. Wow, he's been with them for a long time. That's great. I know back then he was the main person for English speaking and was translating now. So that's good to see. So, yeah, I had similar questions around the camaraderie of everybody going there. At what time did you start your day?
We usually start working at 8 or 8:30 in the morning, depending on, you know, how good we how much we achieved the day before. But we finished not just in time, we finished earlier than expected. So, you know, we started like very early and finished very late. And after the second day, Amano said, okay, we are very fast, and he expects to finish the project earlier than expected. So you can come half an hour later and maybe make a little bit longer break, not just half an hour lunch break, but 45 minutes.
Wow, you only got half an hour lunch breaks at the beginning?
Yes.
Wow.
So, I mean, for you, maybe interesting, a typical day. So a typical day started in the hotel about, I don't know, around 6:30 or around 7 o'clock in the morning. Then we had breakfast all together in the hotel, and then we went by foot to the Oceanarium, which is like 10 minutes, 15 minutes. So it was very close. Then every morning we started like everybody was standing and waiting for Mr. Amano. Then Mr. Amano arrived and said, okay, today we do this, and then we do this, and then we do this. So it was always like a little bit military, I would call it. But such a huge project requires very good organization, and they were very well organized. So typically we had a lunch break about, 12 o'clock. It was like half an hour, sometimes 45 minutes, as I said. And we finished around 6 in the evening. And sometimes we had like 10 minutes, 15 minutes breaks in between. And at all the other time we were working, no breaks, really. So for me, it was like, grab my camera and make the pictures. You know, other people went to the, I don't know, to the toilet and maybe smoking cigarettes. And for me, it was, okay, 10 minutes break, grab my camera and make pictures.
I'm looking forward to seeing those pictures.
Yeah.
So you didn't go to the bathroom during the day. You were taking pictures. That's dedication for you. We all appreciate that, Yudis.
Yeah. Another.
So we are working all the time. So there was maybe one day, I don't know, it was day 3 or 4, when we started planting the first corner, which is the on the from the right side to the left, and the corner behind the I don't know, column, or this, there are some columns inside the aquarium to hold the roof. In the right corner we started, not very right of the aquarium, but the first corner, you know. And it was like I think they were testing first how dense to put the plants together and how it works with all the Wabikusa in this corner. And this was, I believe, the only day we were hanging around for 2 hours, like, you know, without anything to do. And the day after, or after the day was finished, Mr. Amano told us he feels very sorry that we were not involved for such a long time, and he promised the next day we will have work all day long.
Okay. So they started in one corner. I would have thought that, you know, they would take two corners and sort of meet in the middle, but they didn't start that way, huh?
No, we really started in this particular corner. It is so when you are standing in front of the aquarium, you have the left part, the right part, and the middle part. And the corner I'm speaking about is where the middle part and the right part meet each other.
Uh-huh.
This is this corner. This is where they started the planting.
And then went out from there.
So they started there in this corner.
And do you think they had a plan? They planned, they mapped this out, they knew the driftwood they were going to put in where beforehand, or was it kind of more freestyling it as you went along?
The exact placement of the driftwood was more like a freestyle. So we started with the biggest pieces, and Amano said, okay, I want this one over there and this one over there, and like, I don't know, 10 or 15 of us were, you know, like transporting this certain piece of driftwood, which some of them are 3 meters long, and we put them inside the aquarium and, you know, like turn them around the way Mr. Amano wanted it. And so this part was a little bit freestyle, because the driftwood was not in Japan and they haven't prepared the driftwood there, so it was a little bit freestyle. But everything else, the hills and the placement of the plants, everything was mapped. everything, really everything. They had so many sketches, so many planting maps of every area, of every plant species, pictures of every plant, how it looks, I don't know, at the beginning and when it grows. They had a miniature model of the entire aquarium with the planting areas inside and with the hills and with the hardscape. A small miniature model. I don't know, maybe you have seen it like in some of the pictures. We can definitely put one in the show notes.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
Yeah, me neither.
So everything was mapped and planned, and it was so well organized. So really deep respect for this organization. I have never seen something like this before. They also knew where is the plant, where is this, where is everything.
JJ?
So, Yuri, I was going to ask you, did you guys do all the planting in one day? Because I noticed that a lot of it was Wabakusi, but some of it was submerged, I'm sure. How did you guys go about planting all the plants and, you know, especially the ones that need to stay wet? How did you go about keeping them wet?
So we first started with a moss. So we wrapped the driftwood with a moss. Then we wrapped the moss with some kitchen towels, which were wet, and then we covered them with the plastic film.
Plastic, yeah.
And so this was one day, and some stones the same. And the day after, we started, or it was even the same day, we started planting this one corner of the aquarium. And at the end of the day, they covered this corner with a lot of foil. And as you can see in the pictures, there are some like in the open and flat areas, there are like planting holes.
Yeah.
And so they were the first. We planted first those holes because it was very easy to plant them. And then they used like metal wire to build something like a small roof over these planting holes, not to damage the plants inside, and then also covered with plastic foil. And on the hills, they planted one hill with the Wabakusi and covered this by foil. But after this step, there were too many plants inside, you know, like all the ferns and anubias attached to plants. So they were spraying water all day and all night long. So some of the Japanese staff and some of the oceanarium staff, they, you know, were like somebody
taking
had to, you know,
turns.
Yeah, take care for 2 hours and then go back to hotel or to home. Then somebody else arrived and they changed. So they were spraying water all night long.
You know, we need to try and get Nozomi Hayakawa on the podcast here and ask him what it took really to plan this and how long and what things they anticipated, what things they didn't. I think that would be fascinating to understand. Maybe we can reach out to him, but that was going to be one of my questions as well, right? How do you keep these plants? Because you're not going to flood the tank day one, yet you're working over a series of days. How do you keep them moist? And that's amazing that they had that manpower.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like we were, I don't know, like 30 plus people. At the end, we were even more people from the oceanarium joined us. And so from the point we started planting plants, not the moss, the real plants, there were, I don't know, like 4 or 5 people spraying all the time. 4 or 5 people were just spraying all day long. Of course, they changed somebody else. I was also spraying for several hours.
Wow, how is that like? It drives me crazy just spraying.
Yeah, but you see the people working, you see what happens, you can talk to them and just keep spraying. And there was, you know, the aquarium is built like there is on the very right side of the aquarium at the bottom, there is a, I don't know how to call it, like in the bath, you know, where the water sinks.
Okay, so like a drain?
Yeah.
Okay.
And because the people were spraying all the time with the water, we had, when we started with this, we had like 5 centimeters or maybe maximum 10 centimeters of water in the aquarium. And there was a stream from the right side to the left side to the drain, you know, where it moved away all the time. So. Right. By the time we were working, we washed, you know, all the dirt out of the aquarium and also from the sand, but the sand was pre-washed. And they told us that it took them like, I don't know, 2 months to clean all the stones and all the sand.
Wow.
They washed all the sand and let it dry in the sun during the summer. And all the stones were cleaned with the, I don't know, acid, and then, you know, again washed with water to remove this acid and to make them really clean. And it took them 2 months working every day just to prepare the hardscape for this aquarium.
Wow, that's amazing.
The staff of the Oceanarium did this.
Yuri, that would have been a good time for you to break out your shirt that says keep calm and spray.
Yeah. Keep spraying or keep wrapping, right? Wrap the moss. So if I understand you correctly, there's these planting areas, and in this, what's in there? Aqua soil? Is it power sand aqua soil, or what did they use?
You mean these planting holes in the bottom, yes, in the flat area? Yeah. So there is the one layer of pumice stone, which is the normal power sand. Then there is a layer of power sand special. And both together are like 10 centimeters. And then there is, I believe, 20, 30 centimeter thick layer of aqua soil, Amazonia.
Amazonia. And the rest is just the sand that was washed.
Yeah, around it.
Right. Okay.
I got a question, Yuri.
First of those planting, excuse me, JJ, those planting holes, they were deeper than the regular bottom of the aquarium. So while the planting holes are like 40 or 50 centimeters deep, the sand area is just like 2 or 5 centimeters deep.
So the bottom is not glass. It's something like concrete or something?
Yeah, it is concrete. And just the front panels are made from acrylic. And in the back, there are 5... like windows, and they are illuminated from the back.
So you get illumination coming from the back.
Yes. So it looks like, you know, like you have a
sunrise.
Not a sunrise. It looks like in a normal tank, you put milk foil on the back of your tank, and you have a backlit.
Okay.
Okay.
So it looks like this, and they have 5 big windows in the back of the aquarium.
Got it.
So my other question is equipment. What are they doing for like lighting, filtration, CO2, fertilizing?
Okay. So the filtration is done by
water changes.
The filtration is done by 3 or 5 huge sumps. They're really huge. Like, I don't know, 2,000-3,000 liters each. Just the sump, just one of them. And the lighting is in total, is a metal halides mix of, I believe, 6,500 Kelvin and 10,000 Kelvin. So they have the average lighting temperature around 8,000 Kelvin. And in total, 56,000 watt.
Wow.
Yeah, that 8K is something that ADA really likes? Because I'm thinking way back to the first tubes, and 8K was what they were, but maybe they've expanded now.
This is the first a mono aquarium, which is not illuminated by a Grand Solar. They used a different type of lighting, something industrial. Okay. Because each one is like 2 times 400 watt in each lamp. And right. They have like 70 of them, so we have 56,000 in total.
Right. So he had to use a combination of Kelvins to reach the spectrum that he wants.
Yes, and what else do we have? What are changes? They have a huge ion exchange resin to make the tap water to soften it and do some extra filtration and treatment. And the CO2 is injected by a Venturi system. Mm-hmm. And you guys ever heard about it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and how much CO2 are they having to go through?
I don't know. They have some very huge canisters.
Yeah,
I mean, something you usually use to fill up our small bottles.
Yeah. Why don't you briefly?
They have a compressor.
Excuse me.
They have one of the compressors on the site there.
Compressor or what?
Yeah, you said the thing that they use to fill our little tanks.
Yeah, the big tank, I'm assuming that's what Yudis meant.
Yeah, they use like, I don't know what's inside, 20 kilograms CO2 or 25 kilogram bottles.
Those huge like, ones.
Yeah, they're really like 1.5 meter high or something like this.
Yeah.
And they have a few of them. And they use the Venturi system to put the CO2 in the water.
Yeah, can you explain that? Because I'm sure there's some people that's a first for.
Okay, imagine you have a tube and then there is a water flow with the high pressure, and then the diameter of the tube is getting smaller, so the pressure is getting higher. And the time the pressure is the highest at the thinnest point of the tube, CO2 is injected. And after this point, the tube again gets wider and the pressure is sinking. And at the time the pressure in the water is sinking, it absorbs the CO2. It simply sucks the CO2 inside of the water molecules. And it is so effective. This technique is used, I believe, in every marine skimmer, protein skimmers. And they use the same technique in the marine tanks to put a lot of the oxygen in the water.
Yeah, there's been a this is obviously beyond the scope of this podcast. Maybe we should do another one on this high-tech aspect to it. It is, as you rightly said, Yudis, it's Venturi's been used for many, many years for many different things. Typically, it's used to insert oxygenate or bubbles into the water. And you see it, the technology, most commonly in protein skimmers on the marine side. But you're right, it's extremely effective to drive CO2 or other gas into solution. So, but anyway, well, that's the topic for another podcast.
And everything is automated. There is so much automatization behind the tank. The water level in the sumps is monitored by lasers, and they have pH control. Total hardness control, everything is automated and controlled, and they have, I don't know, like a computer where is everything connected, and it looks, like a spaceship. So many cables and displays.
I love that, to be honest. And this, again...
But this is really, this is beyond the normal hobbies.
Right.
Because this is...
I'm sure the cost... is crazy.
Some of the tanks they have in the oceanarium for the shark is like 1 million liter. So this is some technique they use in those huge tanks.
And it's when you're working in such a large scale, and I'm going to ask you about scale now in terms of how different it was for you working in such a large scale as opposed to the normal scale that we're used to, which is the regular aquariums. But in when you're dealing with such large volumes of water, you do need to automate a lot of this stuff. And it's easier because you're putting in bigger quantities, not minute quantities that you would be using in a much smaller aquarium like we have at home. Having said that, and again, this is beyond the scope of this one, but maybe just teasing or throwing it out there, I'm a huge fan of automation, mostly because I travel a lot for business, and I'm not here to be able to do what you would normally do on a daily or every two-day basis. So my tank, my personal tank, is automated significantly. Everything from maintaining water levels to fertilization, CO2 addition, lighting, temperature. I have had in the past hardness. I don't do that anymore. I don't need to, but I have done it in the past. And it works great when it's working. But like any technology, when something breaks, you're in trouble. So I'm sure they're staffed constantly, unlike a home, unlike mine. So therefore, anything goes wrong, I'm sure they have an alarm that goes off and they fix it. But it's fascinating to see that.
We had a behind the scene tour in the oceanarium itself. And they have some sort of control room with many, many computers and displays, where they can monitor every single aquarium in the oceanarium, all the parameters, and can control the speed of all the, you know, the flow of all the pumps and the lighting intensity and everything. It's like NASA, you know.
Yeah, that's one of the things I was going to ask you, flow. Because in such a large aquarium, especially a U like this, did they have pumps in addition to the regular filtration?
As I said before, they have multiple sumps, sump filters, and they have multiple overflows and multiple
jets,
pipes, you know, where the water is pumped back into the aquarium.
But those are coming from the sumps.
Yeah,
they're like in the back side of the tank, yeah. Right?
Yeah, like they're built pool,
like a pool jet almost.
Yeah, they're built in the back side of the aquarium. There are always like three of them.
So you have the overflow going into the sump, and then the outflow from the sump back in is through these holes that you're mentioning in the back of the aquarium. And that is providing the circulation.
Yeah.
They don't have a closed loop system where it's not filtration, it's just pushing water around.
No.
Okay.
I think it's all goes through the filter. I'm not sure, but
yeah. I remember seeing a picture that had a bunch of the little the heads on the wall, like you would see in a pool.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
The jets, the nozzles. Now, Yudis, you're a professional aquascaper and you scape all the time, and most of the time, I'm sure you're working in nanos or you're working in what we would call larger aquariums, but even the larger aquariums don't compare to the scale of this big one. Was it hard from an aquascaping point of view, increasing the scale and making it look right for that size aquarium?
No, I don't think so. The point is, I can spend one day making a nano tank. Because, you know, of very minimalistic details, you know. And this big aquarium is made, you know, not with so many details. So the smallest planting area is, I believe, like, I don't know, like... It's difficult to say. I think it's like, let's say 60 by 40 centimeters is the smallest planting area for one individual plant. So the areas with individual plants, they're very big.
Right.
And in the branches of the root are also big. They're not so small. And for this reason, the difficulty was to keep the view of the aquarium from far away. Because when you are very close, you don't see the shape, you don't see the detail. You have to check from far away. And for this reason, they created planting maps, and they used, bamboo sticks or cocktail sticks in our aquariums to separate areas from each other to make visible, okay, this area is one plant, this area is for another plant. And they used some sticks with the different colors, and they separated the areas like in their planting map. So it was very easy. You had the area, and you have to fill it with the Wabikusa, for example, stem plants mix, or Echinodorus mix, yeah, or with the another type of plant. So we were always like filling gaps in certain areas with one plant species. So for me, it was not visible how it will look like afterward, or how it looks from far away, because I was too close to the aquarium. And it's maybe like, you know, you have a cornfield and you would like to, make very big letters. So you have to get into the plane or helicopter to see it from the top, and then navigate somebody on the bottom how to make it.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah. Problem, because yeah, the aquarium is so big.
Yeah, I think, you know, what I'm getting from that is that the planning aspect to this was key. I mean, to make sure that everything was scaled correctly, and they obviously had a planting plan and brought the tools that would facilitate them when they're there on location to know where to put it.
They even had planting density maps. For every plant species, they had the sheet of paper with some dots on it, different size, and this was showing how dense one has to plant this particular plant species.
That's amazing. So they were even telling you, this one here needs to go in a more dense planting, this one a little bit less, etc.
So for every plant species, there was one sheet of paper with the plant density, how to plant it, like one, and the scale was 1:1. So for example, let's take a regular sheet of paper, and we do planting hair grass, for example. So it was like small dots, like 1 centimeter diameter, and there was space between the dots also like 1 centimeter. But for example, tiger lotus was used. The dots were bigger, like 5 centimeter in diameter, and the space to the next dot, to the next plant, was like 5 centimeter. And we were able to check the space between the plants with those sheets of paper.
That's amazing. That's fascinating.
Everything was mapped, organized, and prepared, really. I spent, half a day together with one Japanese guy. He was inside the aquarium, and I was outside the aquarium. And to make the sand, flat, and everywhere the same level. And we spent half a day for half tank. There was another group. We started on the left side, and they started on the right side, and then we met in the middle. So like 4 people spent half a day, like 4 or 5 hours, just leveling the sand.
Unbelievable.
And I was using I don't know how to call it, scale or something, so the sand should be in front of the glass only 2 centimeters.
So you were there measuring and making sure that it was only 2 centimeters.
Yeah, I was outside measuring and giving him inside instructions just by my hands, because he was not speaking English.
Right.
And also it was not possible to speak through the acrylic. So with my hands, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down, making waves with my hand, pointing there, giving him instructions what to do. Because when you are inside and the area in front of you is like square meters and you have to flatten the sand and there is 5 centimeters of water above it, you don't see any small hills or any, you know, like waves or mouths. So you really need somebody outside who can go down to the water level and check.
Yeah, things you take for granted in smaller aquariums here become large projects like that.
Mm-hmm.
So
one more.
Go ahead.
One more thing was also very amazing. The preparation of plants. I don't know. Do you have some questions about this?
I can only imagine. It takes me a while to prepare plants before I'm going to plant. How did they do it there when you had so many?
Do we have numbers? How many plants were used?
Yeah, not in the number of plants. They said species of plants. I have 46 species of aquatic plants, but I have no idea how many plants were used.
That was a lot. I saw pictures of like boxes stacked 4 feet high full of plants.
Did you have a team prepping them?
Sorry?
Did you have a team of people prepping them?
Yeah. Multiple times. So sometimes we prepared the plants for the next day, you know, like open the box, take one bag, rearrange the plants, put some air inside, and then close the bag again so there is more air inside. And I think there are like 70,000 plants, individual plants, been used in this aquarium.
That's insane.
Wow. Yeah.
Of course, you know, when we use one Babicusa, this is... One Babicusa covers area like 10 by 10. And there is a high amount of individual plants on one Babicusa. But sometimes we were planting, for example, Vallisneria or Blixa or Echinodorus tenellus. We were planting them one by one, huge areas. And so the total amount is crazy. And from the leftovers of the plants, we were very, very close to, you know, like perfect. Just a few plants were left over. And as mentioned before, the preparation of the plants, for example, the Anubias. So first, we checked all the Anubias and removed all the damaged leaves. Then we separated the Anubias by size, smaller, bigger. And then we separated each group by beauty, the more beauty one and the less beauty one. So the small beauty ones were used on the tips of the branches in the front of the aquarium, and the bigger beauty ones were used at the bottom in the front of the aquariums, and the same with the less beauty ones were used in the back on the tips of the wood and on the bottom. Can you imagine this?
Yes, I'm speechless, in awe. That's great. You're taking into account scale, beauty, and whatnot.
And we were like double or triple checking the plants sometimes. And, you know, for a certain period of time, I was like the final checker, you know, who was making the final check and separating the beauty and the less beauty. And then, I don't know the name, one Japanese guy came to me and told me I should not be too picky. They require more of the more beauty ones. So it should be less picky, you know. This was funny. And I don't know, all the ferns, you know. The ferns, they have sometimes damaged leaves and they're cut off. And there is still a small piece of the stem of the leaf, and where we had to trim them off, cut them off very close to the root zone, like every single fern.
Sounds like a lot of work.
And there were small carpeting Babicusa with the Hydrocotyla species, we were using tweezers and picking out every single yellow leaf or brownish or damaged leaf. So just only 100% perfect plants and leaves in perfect shape and condition were put inside the aquarium. This was definitely a lesson, you know. I never done this before. Most of my tanks, I put the plants inside. I know they need time to transform anyway. And there will be some melting and some leaves will die off anyway. So why should I care so much before I put them inside the tank? But the philosophy behind this is that every single damaged leaf you can remove before you put the in the aquarium is less...
Less work being put in there, right?
Yes.
So
it's less contamination for the water, for
exactly, example. Exactly. Guys, we're running on an hour here. You know, I have one last question, but JJ, do you have any more?
No, I think I covered them all.
Okay, Yudis, just if you can sum it up, I mean, what was this experience like for you?
I would call it a one-in-a-lifetime experience. I'm very lucky. I was chosen, you know, to go there. I'm very happy. I've been there, and you know, this is really some really unique memories. I will, you know, maybe speaking about years later, and. I'm really looking forward when the exhibition will open to go there to see it again. And also, I think one major experience was, you know, working with so many great people. So not only we created the aquarium and collected experience, but we made friends.
That's great. That's great. Sounds like an amazing experience.
Yeah, that's cool.
Spain and visit the guys in Poland, and because we spend 1 week every day working from morning till evening together, and we went to the restaurant, we were drinking beer, we were laughing, making jokes together, and this really made us became friends. And we are speaking 1 hour about this project, and there are still so many details to share. I will be writing an article for my German magazine I'm writing for, and I will also recap this on my webpage in German language, but maybe, you know, there will be tons of pictures, so you can watch the pictures and listen to this Capeful episode. And I really recommend everybody to go there to visit the exhibition, because for me, you know, like a dream became true, because I was planning for many years to go to Japan, but it's very expensive. I'm self-employed and it's very difficult, you know, to go for a longer period on vacation. And for me, this was really unique opportunity to meet Mr. Amano and participate in some sort of seminar. And I believe this is the most extensive seminar ever made by ADA. So there were some seminars in the past for the distributors, for example. And for me, a dream became true, because I participated in such an event, and it happened in Europe, and I didn't have to go to Japan. So guys, really, if you love aquascaping and you would like to go to Japan, but for some reasons too expensive or what, and this is in Europe, maybe more close and maybe more easy, it's more affordable. So go there and make the experience. This is really unique.
And there you have it. I think it is a once in a lifetime. It's an amazing experience, and so glad you were able to share it with us here. We'll have more information and obviously the pictures and videos in the show notes. Again, scapefood.com/29. So why don't we wrap it up, guys?
Okay.
Yes, sir.
So if you liked what you heard, please go to iTunes and give us a rating, leave a review, and then subscribe. It's the easiest way to make sure you don't miss an episode. This will be downloading an episode to you automatically, so you don't have to worry about missing any episode. And it's very easy. There's three ways really to subscribe to the Scape Food Podcast. One is iTunes. You can see the link in the show notes, or just go to iTunes and type in Scape Food and you'll see us there. Just hit subscribe and you're done. You can also subscribe via RSS if you use RSS. That's also on our website, or via Stitcher if you use Android. Again, links on the show notes. We'd love to hear from you about today's topic or really any other topic. How can we help you? We're trying to bring value to you. What do you think is going to be of interest? What are you struggling with? We'd love to bring you an episode on that. Just send us an email. That's the easiest way to get a hold of us. You can send one to me, Art, and that's at art@scapefood.com. JJ is at jj@scapefood.com, and Yudis is at js@scapefood.com. We will share the email with us, or really, I don't want to give you too many emails, but you can also just send one to feedback@scapefood.com, and all three of us get it. So with that, guys, thank you so much. This was fascinating. And now I'm off to get myself a grande Starbucks coffee. I will talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Scape Food Podcast, where it's all about learning to make aquariums beautiful.